The election of 2016 will, you can describe it in a lot of different ways, but I think we can already agree that it's going to be considered memorable. And among the many vociferous and impassioned comments that we hear from both sides, from all sides of the political spectrum, is that the comment, how could those clowns vote for so-and-so? Don't they understand what he or she stands for? Don't they know anything? That brings up a very important constitutional and political question. What is the level of the political and constitutional knowledge of the American electorate, and does it matter? I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's all about political and constitutional knowledge.
Stay tuned for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
If you're a longtime listener, you've heard me speak to or make reference to my buddy Patrick Baker on a number of occasions. He and I were colleagues for years, and now he's moved on to greener pastures at a place called the University of Tennessee at Martin. Most recently, we spoke to him about Title IX, an interesting and actually rather tragic subject in some cases, the issues of sexual harassment on campus and what campus police and authorities are doing about them. But today we have a happier subject. But also connected to Patrick, because you see, Patrick has a colleague at the University of Tennessee at Martin. His name is Anderson Starling. He's from the political science department, political communication, and he specializes in things like elections and public opinion. And he has done a lot of research and is continuing to do research into a really foundational subject. That is political knowledge. Now, bear with me on this one. It gets a little theoretical, but it's also very practical. We have a majoritarian constitution. That is, we are essentially a democratic republic, which means that we vote on most of the major issues that come before the nation. And most Americans get to vote. If you're 18 years of age, if you're mentally competent, if you're not a felon, then in all likelihood, you are eligible to vote. But voting is based upon the premise that when you vote, you know what you're voting about. That is, you have a certain basic level of political knowledge about the candidate, if it's a political election, or about the issue, if it's a referendum, or about more generally the issues and the problems facing the nation. And upon that knowledge, you base what we hope is an informed choice at the ballot box. But do Americans really have that sort of political knowledge, or more properly, do they have enough political knowledge? That's what Anderson researches. And so stay tuned for a really fascinating and foundational discussion.
My name's Anderson Starling. I'm an assistant professor of political science at the University of Tennessee at Martin.
We are very deep into West Tennessee now, aren't we?
Absolutely. About as deep as it goes. We are just a few minutes from the western border. So.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So now we know where Martin is.
Right.
Where did you come from? Forgive me for saying this, but you don't sound like a native. I say that with all respect. My family is actually from this part of the country. You don't sound like you're from here.
No.
Where are you from?
I am originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, is where I grew up, and did high school there, and then moved down to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to attend the university there for both undergraduate and graduate school.
Do you want to say Roll Tide?
I absolutely do. Roll Tide.
Okay, there we are. And what kind of political science do you study?
In general, I focus on political behavior. Within American political behavior, I focus mostly on public opinion and political knowledge. And even within that subject, I focus a lot on the use of internet and media.
I'm so glad that we're talking today because, of course, as you know, this is a show about the Constitution. The Constitution sets out what we call a majoritarian system, which, with some caveats on some individual rights, means that basically we vote on everything. And so a majoritarian government proceeds upon the premise that people will vote, and even more fundamentally, that people will vote knowledgeably, that they will know what they're voting about, and
right,
that they're making reasoned decisions. In fact, the Constitution is very much an 18th century document, It's the Age of Reason. It's the Enlightenment. The whole concept is of an enlightened electorate. Madison himself was fond of saying that knowledge will forever govern ignorance. Hmm. But is that always true? I mean, a lot of people, and I'm not taking sides, but a lot of people are expressing concern in this presidential election year of 2016 that a lot of voters are not really informing themselves about the issues. They're not informing themselves about the candidates. They're voting on some other basis. So this is a fascinating and very timely topic. So tell me about what you do. Tell me more about your work.
Absolutely. So the political science literature over the last 70 or so years suggests that while we in general are not that knowledgeable about politics, the not knowledgeable level that we are at has been consistent. So there's no less knowledge these days or any more knowledge for the most part.
That's a very interesting point because, of course, you'll always hear people saying this. Oh, people used to read newspapers. People used to know more. But you're telling me the opposite. You're saying that this is more or less the same level of knowledge we've had for a long time?
The same low level, but yes.
Okay. So it's been consistent, but consistently low.
Correct.
Well, here, let me just say, though, and maybe I'm sounding Pollyannish here. But even if that's true, even in fact, I tend to think it probably is, just based on my own anecdotal experience. But if that's true, if we've managed somehow to muddle through 229 years of our existence since the Constitution was adopted, maybe that's some reason for comfort.
Absolutely.
I mean, seriously, I mean, does that make sense to you at all?
It certainly does.
We managed to win World War II, didn't we? I mean, so we, by golly, we can face up to today's challenges, even if we're still too ignorant.
Absolutely. So there's kind of two parts to the political knowledge quandary or conundrum. And one is, should we have more knowledge? And the other is, how much knowledge do we have? One is more a normative argument. The other is a more objective argument. From a normative standpoint, you would think we can never have too much knowledge and that any increases would be great. From an objective standpoint, you know, we have a lot of research that shows there are very few instances where the American people really need each of us to be so well informed. The literature suggests that many of us, due to maybe cognitive dissonance or cognitive laziness, right, don't want to go out and find out all the information about politics ourselves and instead are fine listening to opinion leaders who themselves are generally well-informed in a way that they can make signals to those who follow or listen to them. This is the right decision. Maybe if you did research on your own, you might feel a little bit differently, but in general, this is a good way to go one way or the other.
So it boils down to whom do you trust?
Exactly. Absolutely.
That's again, consistent with the impression that I've had, especially in the last few years, is when you try to probe to people, why do you think that? You know, why do you believe this sort of thing? It comes down to the individual people they're listening to or often the particular websites they like to visit.
Absolutely.
And so that's basically what it is. People have, do you think they've given up on doing their own research? Is it laziness or is it a sense that they're not competent? What makes people want to simply follow someone's lead?
I think it has a lot to do with interest. If someone has a pet issue that they really care about, right, be it gay rights or abortion or gun rights or farming subsidies or whatever it is that is important to them, that interest will often lead them to research that one interest. And therefore, they can make electoral decisions based on the interest that's most important to them. There are others of us, I would say you and I included, to which the whole realm of politics is important. And we like to look at a much larger picture, the full forest, if you will. And, you know, to do the adequate amount of research on many, many things takes time and effort. And not everybody's ready to do that, but some absolutely are. Therefore, they are willing to spend that time and learn those things and then make well-informed decisions. It's hard to say someone is too informed, but, you know, with a wealth of information.
It's funny you should mention that. I think probably that's a perfectly reasonable perspective to take. Given the fact that the world is complex.
Sure.
I can't be an expert in everything. I can maybe be an expert in one thing or maybe two things, but I can't be an expert in everything. And even the most well-informed citizen can't, well, I guess retirees or those who are independently wealthy can spend all day simply looking at the internet or reading newspapers
sure.
or going to the library, but not all of us are blessed in that way. You know, the average working Joe or Jane, you know, they've got kids, they've got a job, they've got other responsibilities, they might be very interested in politics, but they realize that they can't go out and do all their research. So maybe they do some on one or two issues, and they find people who are saying things they agree with, and then maybe they say, well, if he's right on farm subsidies, then he's right on gay rights, or he's right on abortion, or he's right on international affairs.
It's an argument right out of the Federalist Papers
right.
that suggests if we all go after our number one interest, then our collective number one interests will be the will of the people. And therefore, we can make good electoral decisions without needing to be complete experts in everything.
Well, again, that gives me some degree of comfort because I've grown accustomed to listening to criticisms of the common folk, the common voter, as being ignorant and uninformed. But you're telling me that, or I'm telling you, I'm agreeing with you, that maybe complete knowledge is impossible. It is. And even something really close to comprehensive knowledge is impossible as a practical matter for most citizens in a democratic republic. So maybe it's not that bad.
And additionally,
is that the point you're making? This,
I would believe so. I think additionally, it's not as if we have 15 different choices. For the most part, in most elections, unless it's a very rare, sometimes congressional election or maybe an at-large city council district, you usually just have two options. And needing to do lots and lots of research about both sides is less and less common, right? We have opinion leaders, be they people we trust or local party leaders or the newspaper, the editorial board of a newspaper or something like this that says, okay, of the two choices, this one is the one we like. And then people themselves don't have to go through this whole process of winnowing issue by issue. They just listen to the opinion leaders that they trust, know and trust.
Right. And maybe that's not that bad.
Maybe not.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Anderson Starling, a member of the faculty at the University of Tennessee at Martin, all about political knowledge. What sort of knowledge do voters, American voters, actually have when they go to the polls? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll speak some more with Anderson Starling. Stick around. Doug Smith, the quiz guy, is in the house.
Hello, Stuart.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing you're wearing an Argyle sweater today.
I am. I'm feeling very Alex P. Keaton.
You are very Alex P. Keaton today. Perhaps we'll have a conservative question. Do you have a contestant on the line?
Yes, we do.
Oh, who are you, sir?
I'm TD.
TD?
Touchdown!
Okay, Doug is making the upraised cross. What do they call the uprights? The upright signal, exactly right. Well, TD, that's tremendous. What does TD stand for?
Well, my name is Timothy Daniel, and my dad was a football coach, so touchdown's relevant, but they also call me their tax deduction.
Nice.
Where are you from, TD?
I'm from Crossville, Tennessee.
Crossville, Tennessee. Where's Crossville, Tennessee?
It's on I-40 between Knoxville and Nashville, about halfway.
Gosh, a lot of people are from that region. We've had several callers. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Oh, it's a big golfing community down there. A lot of good golf if you're into that.
Oh, sure, absolutely. It's a gorgeous area, gorgeous area. Well, are you ready to do a quiz, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Doug, have at him.
All right, TD, I'm going to ask you a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
What two corporate giants will fight it out in the Supreme Court this fall over patent infringement?
Mm.
So what two corporate giants will fight it out this fall in the Supreme Court over patent infringement? Will it be A, Ronco versus the ShamWow Man?
Vince, the ShamWow Man.
Is it B, Google versus AOL?
Mm.
C, Samsung versus Apple? Or D, Hobby Lobby versus Michael's Arts and Crafts?
Once again, what's the question? Once again, I got to hear this one again.
What two corporate giants will fight it out in the Supreme Court over patent infringement? Is it A, Ronco versus the ShamWow Man? B, Google versus AOL? C, Samsung versus Apple? Or D, Hobby Lobby versus Michael's Arts and Crafts?
I think I know this one, but I'm not going to give you any hint. What do you think, TD?
I don't know for sure, but my initial gut reaction would have said Hobby Lobby.
Hobby Lobby. Why would you think Hobby Lobby would be worried about patents?
Well, you got me there. I heard the names, and that was
well, Hobby Lobby is a very prominent name in constitutional law lately. It is.
Oh, without question.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've made it a run at the course.
Do they have patents on arts and crafts at Hobby Lobby? Isn't that what they sell? I don't know. I don't really know. What about Vince, the ShamWow guy? You know, those Germans make good stuff.
That's the one I eliminated.
How could you eliminate Ronco and the ShamWow Man?
Exactly. Ronco from our youth. You and I are showing our age. Is Ronco even still around?
Yes.
Really? It is around. Okay.
Yeah, they make those cookers that have no heating elements.
Oh, I'm not watching enough late night TV, I guess. Okay. So it's not Ronco.
You can set it and forget it.
I remember that one. Okay. So you're thinking it's Hobby Lobby then?
That's going to be my best guess. I didn't assume I had any lifelines to reach out.
It's not at all. But just once again, this is there are two corporate giants fighting it out over
patent infringement.
Patent infringement. Okay. Yeah. And so Hobby Lobby's your gut's telling you.
Yeah. Complete yes, though. I'm familiar with the case.
All right. Doug?
I'm afraid, TD, you did not get that. Yes, you
failed.
You weren't even in the red zone, brother.
Oh man, that's terrible. Don't
it
be
is
mean,
Samsung though. Versus Apple.
I was thinking it would be
patent infringement. Okay. And the case is really—I mean, the reason it's going to the Supreme Court. This is really about how much Samsung has to pay Apple.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they've already determined. This is the case about the design actually of the iPhones.
Yeah, and they want to limit the case to, you know, a particular calculation related to what the components cost.
Right.
And, you know, Apple and all the developers and designers are saying, no, this is a much bigger case than that. But this is that Apple, Samsung, you know, they've been battling it out.
They've been battling it for years and years. And, yeah. Of course, Apple, they're, I think, the essence of their appeal is their design.
Well, and all the designers, of course, are siding with Apple for that very reason.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Samsungs do look awfully similar to Apple iPhones. On the other hand, how many different ways are there to design something that's basically a rectangle that fits in your pocket? I mean, how many cars look very, very similar as well? So, I mean, I'm not really that familiar with all the issues in the case, but this is a big one, and I've been hearing about this for a long time, so it certainly bears watching. Well, we're sorry that you didn't win, TD, but we will be sending you a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier if you'd be kind enough to email us at ywc@montpelier.org. That's MONTPELIER.org. And send us your address, and we will mail you one of those pocket constitutions.
That's great. Thanks
All
so
right.
much, guys.
Thank you, and thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I can set it, but never forget.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Anderson Starling, a professor at the University of Tennessee at Martin, who researches political knowledge. How do people get, and what sort of knowledge do they get in order to make informed decisions at the polling places? It turns out that a number of Americans don't do a lot of the research themselves. Instead, they rely upon influential people that Anderson calls opinion leaders. So is that what your work has shown you? Is that the conclusion you've reached?
One of the really nice things about being at a small university is I'm allowed to have my research sort of wind around issues. Mm-hmm. And some years I'll finish a project and set it aside, and then I'm kind of wide open to what I want the next one to be. So while they're all related, they can be slightly different. One project that I'm embarking upon right now is what is whether or not internet use is a polarizing force, a force that is pushing us as Americans towards opposite ends of the political spectrum rather than informing us in a sort of objective political knowledge measure, you know, 1 points, 2 points, 3 points. Instead, those who are conservative are going to conservative websites and, for lack of a better term, learning the conservative version of the facts, and those who are liberal are going to liberal websites and learning the liberal version of the facts. And what it ends up is with two different views of reality.
I believe the term is confirmation bias.
Absolutely.
It? We're looking not to learn new things. We're looking for people and websites and sources that are going to confirm what we already think is true.
Right.
And then again, that reinforces it, because if I go to this website and they agree with me on, I don't know, climate change or whatever, well, if they're smart enough to do that, then I should listen to them on foreign trade, or I should listen to them on something else. And I suspect we're all guilty of that to some extent.
Absolutely.
I know that I have to fight it. It's much more comforting and fun to read somebody who's going to skewer your opponents and do it in a creative way than it is to go out and actually read your opponents and see what they have to say.
Well, cognitive dissonance, which is that sort of uncomfortable feeling you get when someone tells you something perceived as true that doesn't meet up with what you already think.
And it's uncomfortable.
Cognitive dissonance is uncomfortable. And we as humans, not Americans or low income, low education, high income, high education, as humans, we avoid it when we can. And politics, especially in the United States, that has become so polarized, and more importantly than polarized, so sordid, has allowed people to avoid cognitive dissonance very easily.
Right. You just avoid people and things. You start unfollowing people on Facebook.
Absolutely.
Things that you don't like.
Absolutely.
Something, again, I have to resist. I mean, if I see a certain person posting something that I really find offensive or really unpleasant, or maybe even just repetitive.
Absolutely.
The temptation is just to unfollow or even unfriend in some circumstances if you're willing to make a statement. I have on several occasions, and I'm not singling anybody out, and I'm not going to mention names, I've specifically decided, no, I'm going to make sure I don't do that.
Right.
Because I want to keep seeing posts from this person who just keeps beating this dead horse. Because, you know, that maybe that person disagrees with me. But I've made a conscious decision to endure the cognitive dissonance. You know, maybe they've got a point.
Right.
And it's painful.
And that's an absolutely.
It's not fun. I'd much rather just see cats, you know, and funny videos and people agreeing with you.
Look up Alabama football stats or something.
There
like
you
this.
Are,
yeah.
Exactly.
As someone who studies social media and the internet and political behavior on the internet, I'll say I left Facebook a long time ago.
Did you really?
I did. But mostly because it just didn't do it for me. I was more interested in, rather than people posting articles, I'd go find the articles myself. Mm-hmm. And again, it's tough to force myself into some cognitive dissonance. Whoa, there's this article that suggests maybe the way I see the world is not correct. Mm-hmm. Let's go look at it, read it, and see how it works, or why the article is published and so on and so forth.
You know, I find, if I may interject,
again,
cognitive dissonance can be very unpleasant.
Right.
But I will say this, some of the most rewarding experiences I've had are when I make a conscious decision to read somebody or an article or an essay from a perspective I don't necessarily agree with.
Absolutely.
And realize that even if I still ultimately disagree with that position or disagree with some aspects of it, there's some truth in it, too.
Mm, yeah.
And at the very least, even if I still disagree with all of it at the end of it, I've got a better understanding of why people think the way they do. And that has a salutary effect as well, not just in terms of increasing my understanding, but in reminding me that there are very many well-intentioned people. The simple fact that they disagree with me doesn't make them bad.
Mm.
you know, maybe I still think they're wrong or mistaken or misled or whatever. But from their perspective, with their values, they're trying to reach a conclusion that's going to see those values adopted. And if you reduce it to its essentials, most human beings want the same thing.
Right.
They want a certain degree of security. They want a safe place to raise, rear their children, good schools to send them to, more opportunities for themselves, their families, and certainly for the next generation. You know, they want a certain level of comfort.
Just work your way up Maslow's needs hierarchy.
That's
absolutely.
Everyone wants more or less the same thing. It's just that they start with different premises,
sure,
as to maybe about human nature, about how life works. And so they're trying to reach the same thing that I'm trying to reach, but they're coming at it from a different way.
And here's an interesting piece of why maybe we're so polarized these days is because we don't have a lot of that forced cognitive dissonance, right? Just piggybacking on the literature of Robert Putnam and his book Bowling Alone, lamenting the loss of, you know, civic engagement groups and bowling leagues, as the title suggests, as places where people got together and sort of haphazardly had political discussions and sort of iron sharpening iron sharpened each other that way, to where they learned more about politics in general and were able to see how each other feel on issues and then perhaps empathize with each other on political issues. Now, I don't have to go talk to my neighbor at the local barbecue. I don't have to go to the, I don't have to talk to my, one of my partners at the bowling league. You know, it's very rare that young people particularly are involved in civic groups, things like this, where they might be working on a project, but also talking a little bit about the election or their political views on one issue or another. Instead, you know, at the end of the day, when I finish work, I go home and I can get on my computer and go exactly to the website that I know is going to say exactly the things that I exactly agree with already, right? Rather than me learn that other side and then maybe perhaps begin to see it a little bit, I can live in my own bubble on the internet without needing for that bubble to ever pop.
You know what really is getting to me here is that people have always, to some extent, selected their friends and the people they want to hang out with.
Certainly.
But it was kind of hard to exclude people socially that you don't like as much. It's very easy to unfollow somebody on the internet.
Simple
it's much,
click.
Much harder to stop talking to a person who's in your neighborhood at the neighborhood party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you're almost forced to at least be civil and be polite.
Sure.
And again, that's kind of an analog to cognitive dissonance. Oh, I gotta, you know, gotta deal with Barney again today. He's gonna come over here and start railing on something, you know.
Right.
But you know, by dealing with Barney, you got his perspective. And
sure.
You're thinking to yourself, well, you know, maybe he's got a point there after a while. I'm reminded about something similar involving politics, is that gerrymandering's been going on forever.
Sure.
But we've gotten really good at it.
Very good.
I mean, down to individual households.
Absolutely.
And so we can draw lines that are designed with almost pinpoint precision. So it's an old problem, but the technology has made it more of a problem in some respect. I mean, if one group, Republicans or Democrats, they both do it, gets a significant majority one year, and they use those tools, they can almost ensure their survival, except in cases where there's a huge, you know, electoral or demographic shift.
Right.
So gerrymandering and the technology has affected it. So have you concluded that social media really has allowed people or has contributed to polarization then, simply because people are able to select better who they listen to?
It's what I'm working on. That's my theory, is that it certainly is. I think using perhaps some data that includes the amount of time people spend on certain websites. There are a couple of surveys out there that say, you know, when you're looking for information on the presidential race, do you use any of these sites, click all that apply. I think that might allow me to sort of categorize people. These are the kind of people who go to both sides, right? These are the kind of people who go to conservative websites. These are people who go to liberal websites. And then sort of see, does the more they see, if the more they use those sites, the further they place Republicans and Democrats apart from each other, or the further, the more they dislike one party or the other, something like that.
Okay, so that's what you're doing, and you're going to use primarily surveys as your tools?
Right, yeah.
So like SurveyMonkey, those sorts of things?
No, certainly
no,
not.
No, not that. More
There's
scientific.
Nothing wrong with SurveyMonkey, mm-hmm. And given in the right way, a SurveyMonkey survey could be very, very good. But I use typically I use the American National Election Survey, which is a survey funded by a couple of schools and the National Science Foundation, and it's a nationally representative survey with weights to make the data look like census data more appropriately. You know, each year they're adding new items and removing old items that maybe don't work so well anymore. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself is sometimes an issue if you're using an old survey and you like a certain item over time.
It might disappear. Yeah, I understand that could be a real problem. So what you're telling me is that there are lots of surveys out there that are being done with rigorous survey methods.
Sure.
So they're in some sense scientific.
Absolutely.
And you're more interested in analyzing them than you are in conducting your own surveys.
At this point, that would definitely be the case. Mm-hmm. Conducting surveys is an expensive business.
Sure is, yeah.
And so it is easier to, you know, especially when you're in a school that is a part of these consortiums that share data and things mm-hmm. like this, you can access that data as an academic very easily. And I think even as a non-academic, you could access it if you had that desire.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Anderson Starling, a professor at the University of Tennessee at Martin, who studies political knowledge. What sort of knowledge do people have when they cast their ballots, and how do they get it? After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll speak some more with Anderson Starling.
Madison is best known as the namesake for a line of snack cakes and ice cream products, and somewhat less well known for her talents as a hostess and her role in saving the portrait of George Washington from British torches during the War of 1812. But Dolly's greatest contribution to her nation, the legacy we should remember, was the creation of the unofficial office of First Lady. The First Lady fills the crucial need that was quite deliberately unaddressed by the Constitution, the need for the ceremonial. Democracies are characteristically short on ceremony, but they need it more than almost any other kind of governance, wrote noted Dolly biographer Catherine Algor. By the time the Madisons left the presidency in 1817, Washington had become a thriving capital city with a vibrant social life and effective political networks, largely due to the parties Dolly held and the public persona she constructed. Henry Clay once noted, "Everybody loves Mrs. Madison," and Dolly responded, "Mrs. Madison loves everybody." With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with political science professor Anderson Starling of the University of Tennessee at Martin, and we're talking all about political knowledge. If I recall from our lunchtime discussion, you told me that you're not only interested in how people acquire knowledge and the effect of the internet, but you're specifically interested in how young people acquire knowledge. I'm guessing that young people acquire it a bit differently than us old people.
You would think.
I was about to use pejorative terms to describe my own generation, and I held back. But anyway, so us old folks, we get our information differently, by cracky.
Sure. So there's lots of usage data on specific types of media over time and how those uses have changed. Sadly, we all generally know that newspaper readership is down, magazine readership is down, at least in print. Conservative talk radio use is up. There's not much other talk radio.
Hey, there's this show.
Absolutely.
And we go right down the middle, but anyway.
Absolutely. Certainly the rise of podcasts has changed that, right?
Sure.
When I refer to radio, I really mean over the air, everywhere,
right,
sort of a thing, instead of either podcasts that are access on your own or public radio.
Mm-hmm.
Still, the use of the internet has been on the rise, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that just with the use of the internet on the rise does not necessarily mean the use of the internet for political information is on the rise.
Hmm.
They're two very distinct things. And once we as political science began to ask, you know, are you using the internet? And sometimes we take that as a yes or a no and just sort of guess that they were probably using it for political information. And once we started really asking that specific question, we found out that many internet users are not. It's almost the same thing we found out when we started asking, were people watching cable TV for political purposes?
Mm-hmm.
There are 1,000 channels,
mm-hmm.
right? And just because there are political stations doesn't mean people are watching them, right? There's plenty of other things to be watching. You know, should it be MTV or sports or more sports, whatever.
Pornography, whatever
oh,
it might
indeed.
Be. Yeah, I think that's a very important thing, and I think that you're going to have to answer that question in order to analyze the data because, there's a lot of great stuff out there. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, there's a lot of good information on Wikipedia.
Absolutely.
But you have to actually go to it and read it
and that's
think
what,
about it.
And that's what happens with the young people is they have the greatest potential for increases in political knowledge when using the internet,
mm-hmm.
the greatest potential. But unless they are specifically going to the internet to search out that political information, they're just like anyone else, where the internet doesn't really make that much of a difference because you have so many choices as to what you want to go look up and find.
It occurs to me, Anderson, that this is actually a very old argument because I seem to recall that at the dawn of both radio and then subsequently television, that many people embraced it as this wonderful tool that was going to bring education to the masses.
Absolutely.
And you did have lots of educational programming. And when I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, that was all broadcast at about 6:30 on Sunday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
And they would actually call it, you know, home classroom or whatever. And later it occurred to me, you know, how many people are sitting here looking at this lecture on Iranian ancient sculpture at 6:30 on a Sunday morning? And I think the answer is pretty clear. It just was not that many. So just because the technology is there doesn't mean people are accessing it or people are using it. So how do you study that? I mean, you're going to just rely on surveys and rely on what people tell you they're doing using the internet for? I mean, I guess the only other option would be to spy on them.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you could ask people to grant you access to their cameras or access to what's on their screens.
And, I'm more afraid of that than anything else.
Yeah, it's pretty... Well, I mean, it would be voluntary, but then you'd have a trouble getting a representative sample. So unless you could sort of... here's what you do. You contact the National Security Agency, because I know they can do this. And you simply get access to a representative sample of people's screens.
And we tell them it is for science.
No, you don't tell them at all. That's the point.
Okay.
In fact, you could probably... I mean, they got big computers there. You could crunch all the... You could look at everyone.
What
everyone is doing, and then you would know where they're getting their information. But seriously, failing that sort of Big Brother type of surveillance, I don't see any alternative to relying upon some kind of survey. So I guess your next step is then to be designing the sort of survey you want that you think is going to elicit accurate responses from a representative sample of people.
Absolutely. And for the most part on surveys, we find that, especially when we ask information that is later verifiable, with the exception of one or two things, most people are relatively truthful.
What are those exceptions? I got to ask.
One of the exceptions actually is whether or not they voted.
So people will lie and say they did vote.
They will lie and say they did vote.
Because there's a stigma to not voting.
Absolutely. Especially once they realize they're in a political survey.
Okay.
So there are...
What are some of the other ones before we go on? I got to ask.
Yeah. What would be another good one?
It's just private things. I mean, typical private things are money, like their finances.
Right.
Again, sex. I don't want to sound over-sexed here, but I mean, that those are the sorts of things people consider private. I don't know what else. Those are the big ones, aren't they? Politics, money, maybe religion?
Perhaps.
How often do you go to church? Every Sunday.
That is it. Yeah, okay. That's actually it. You jarred my memory. That's the one.
3 times a week. The doors are open.
And they ask a couple of religion questions, and sometimes those are hard to verify, but things like... Or we have evidence that people either lie or exaggerate, at least, on how many times they attend church in a given time period. And then sometimes also the same as how often do they pray or something like this.
Right. That's interesting. Then maybe the initial research has to be on those particular problem areas. and then you try to get a good baseline discount rate. You know, people are going to overstate church attendance by 7%.
Absolutely.
People are going to overstate their income by 6%, whatever. And then, armed with that data, you go back and you can discount answers more generally in general surveys.
Certainly. And the general idea in statistics or statistics-driven science is that for every person that overestimates, you're going to have somebody who underestimates.
So they cancel out?
In hopes that they would cancel out, and that the truth would be somewhere in the middle. And again, with many of these surveys, you're asking between 1,200 and 1,400 people and extrapolating that to all 310 million in the country. So the numbers, it's all part of sort of a distribution that in general we're going to have about the right spot.
Understood. Okay, well, we've been talking in general terms about the direction of your research and maybe where it's going to go next and the sort of tools that you're going to need. And, you know, realizing that it is embryonic at this point, and you're a young whippersnapper. You just got your PhD a couple of years ago, right?
I did in 2014.
Oh, okay. Well, then this is your first academic job, right?
It is.
Well, congratulations. It's a tough environment.
It certainly is. Thank you.
It's a nice place to have to be here. It's a beautiful campus and nice people. Have you come to any sort of preliminary conclusions, or do you have anything to say to the general questions of the era, which are, you know, some people will ask, you know, should we even be encouraging more voting when so many people are low information voters? Should we have some sort of minimum knowledge requirement before we allow people to vote? I mean, I've heard proposals of that sort. Should we require people to pass the same test that people have to pass to become citizens before we let them vote? Do you have any feeling about any of those sorts of issues? Has your research given you a sense of that, or is your research ever going to help you resolve those issues?
I think when we begin to look at setting sort of limits or requirements to voting, you know, of course, we know that money limits or racial limits or whatever, these are wildly unconstitutional.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that even knowledge itself is often, while knowledge is objective, either something is true or something is false, everyone's potential for the same amount of knowledge is not itself objective. So we know...
You mean one person is not capable of absorbing as much as another?
Or not likely.
Or simply not in the position to get it.
Right. And certainly not in the position, right? There are some school systems that are better than others. There are some parents who discuss politics more than others at home. There are... there are some times where we see there are types of facts that males learn better than females, or where the place where you live in a city, you know, connected back to your school district has a difference in what you're going to learn. And I think if we set a minimum bar, we risk losing some people who care about politics but don't maybe have the time or the cognitive energy to go inform themselves completely.
Right.
Again, maybe they're really interested only in farm subsidies, and if we discount them from being able to vote based on the fact that they can't name the Chief Justice of the United States, I think that goes back to that kind of unconstitutional.
Oh yeah, I think constitutionally speaking, it's a thicket. I mean,
absolutely.
Any sort of restriction on the franchise is going to run into about 16 different barriers.
Right.
I understand that. But, you know, you're a political scientist, and so I'm just really kind of looking at it from a policy perspective. And I think that you've already suggested that maybe we don't have as much of a crisis as we think we do.
Certainly.
Even if you accept the premise that more knowledge is better, even if you desire that people make informed choices on a wide range of issues, and every time they cast a vote, that they know what they're doing, what I heard you say at the outset of this conversation is that our relatively low level of knowledge has been fairly constant for a long time, at least as far back as we have data. And by the way, how long is that? You know, I'm sure we don't have surveys going back all the way to 1787 or 1776.
No. Oh, man, that would be amazing.
It would be nice if we did.
Right. Good scientific surveys go back to about the 1940s.
Okay, so since the 1940s, people have more or less the same level of knowledge. So again, that was the example I used. We won World War II. We've put people on the moon. We
created the internet and
sure.
all sorts of other things that are out there. We've had 70 or 80 years of relatively stable, prosperous, democratic government. Things have not been all that bad for all
right.
that period of time.
And in that case, I would suggest that...
So maybe we don't need
exactly.
any sort of limitations.
Exactly. If these sort of limitations would do more potential harm than potential benefit, mm-hmm. where as long as we as Americans can continue to receive messages and information from those we trust and believe in, right, then we're often able to make fairly accurate decisions, fairly accurate voting decisions.
Right. Well, at least from our personal perspective, we're voting for the people and the issues that are going to benefit us, however we define that benefit. And if person A decides that farm subsidies, to use your example, are important to him, and that's what he's going to vote on, well, then who am I to say that's not a basis for voting?
Absolutely.
And if something else, gay marriage, is important to me, mm-hmm. Then who are you to say that that's not, we tend to decry single-issue voters, but
Absolutely.
If that truly is the issue that I care about or that you care about, well, so what? The Constitution doesn't require us to tell the basis of our vote.
Certainly not.
And then I'm also attracted back to something you said that goes apparently all the way back to the founding era. The theory is that if everybody acts in his own interest as he or she sees fit, that the aggregate result will produce a good outcome.
Absolutely.
Do you
Absolutely.
Believe that?
I do.
Do you?
I certainly do. I think if everyone does their part and learns what they think is important, on the aggregate, as you suggest, we'll end up in an okay place. That's the way the system is built.
It's the way it's built, and it is one of the premises, but you know what? It's always struck me as an article of faith.
Absolutely.
I mean, it really does. Now, this is a contradiction here. I mean, the Enlightenment is supposedly an age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
But, and everything's supposed to be reasonable, and everything we're supposed to be able to prove, and everything's based on evidence. But what we're saying here is that we are going to adopt a system of government based upon the idea that the people are capable of governing themselves, and that their collective judgment will ultimately produce, not always, but most of the time and in most circumstances, a good result.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I'm as comfortable with that as you seem to be. Now, you're the expert in this regard, but you can certainly point to particular elections, particular elected officials.
Sure.
And you ask yourself, how could any reasonable person ever vote for that person
mm-hmm.
or vote that way on that issue? And that seems to question the basic premise here.
It does. It certainly does.
Yeah.
I think that because we've been around for 229 years so far, it's done okay. Sure, we do have, bad officers, bad members of government, sometimes objectively so, right? But the fact that it's not one bad one after the next, right, that the country doesn't immediately fall to ruin, gives me faith in the American people that as a collective, we can get it figured out, and that we are it's that theoretical tacit contract that we make, that when we leave the state of nature, the theoretical state of nature, we come into an agreement together that says, okay, let's do this together, because we're better off together than we are fighting out on our own by ourselves. And this group that we've put together here in the United States is better than any other group to us, then let's move forward with it.
Mm-hmm. Let me play devil's advocate.
Sure.
Is it just dumb luck that we've made it this far?
I certainly hope not.
Uh-huh.
Well, because luck tends to run out.
it does tend to run out. I mean, you can look back over history, and it is very contingent.
Sure.
And if you elected this president rather than that president, you might have had a very different outcome.
Certainly possible.
In very important ways. And the stakes have always been high. I mean, the country was in danger of its existence, from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
before the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But we're at a stage now with technology, and especially the advent of weapons of mass destruction and mm-hmm. other technological threats. I wonder whether our luck may be running out. I mean, you know, the system has had a certain amount of slack in it. We could tolerate bad presidents. We could tolerate bad senators. We could tolerate bad decisions. And we paid consequences for them, but they weren't ultimately existential. We've now entered an era where if you have somebody in charge of the nuclear codes who shouldn't be, that's it. I mean, that could be the end of everything, not just our country, but the entire planet.
Right.
So I return again to think, well, you know, do we need to do something to make sure that the decisions we make are of a higher quality than they've been heretofore up to this point?
Right. And I don't want to make it seem like my argument is that we need no changes in political knowledge whatsoever. Again, back to that normative issue, I always think more political knowledge is better. And one of the reasons, perhaps, that political knowledge has remained as constant as it has, or the amount of political knowledge has remained as constant as it has, is because we continue to try and increase it, right? With more civic education, with more...
With all of our efforts, we've managed not to move the needle any.
But it hasn't gone down.
You are a Pollyanna. You are the eternal optimist. Well, I have to say I agree with you. We're running out of time here, so I'll simply, I'll just mention that, of course, that's the whole premise of the show.
Right.
Not specifically political knowledge, but certainly constitutional knowledge, which embraces a lot of political knowledge. And this show is, my efforts are, and the efforts of many, many other people who are involved in civic education or political or constitutional education, are both an acknowledgement of the imperfect level of information, because there's a job to be done, but also I think they're an act of faith, because you're at least hoping that you can move the needle a little bit.
Absolutely.
Or at least prevent it from declining.
Sure.
By doing that sort of thing. So ultimately, that's why you're on the show right now, right? You're trying your best.
Absolutely.
To increase political and constitutional knowledge, even though it might not be so bad if it stays at this level.
Sure. Sure. And you do a great job on this show. It's an amazing show, and I've listened to it many times before and love listening to it continually. And it's things like this that are good for the country, and it's shows like this that give me that confidence that we as an American people will continue to inform ourselves, albeit slowly, but at least enough to keep us going and keep that dumb luck alive.
Let's hope so. Well, Anderson Starling of the University of Tennessee at Martin, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us and your research, and we'll come back and speak to you again sometime, and you can tell us what more you've learned about political knowledge and young people and the internet and all that good stuff.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, everybody. We're students from the Rock Podcast, and whether you're a Democrat or Republican, we're here to ask you to be informed, to be educated, and to get out there and vote. And let's get it!
That's our show. Thanks very much to Anderson Starling of the University of Tennessee at Martin. And thanks also to my buddy Patrick Baker, who now teaches there. And even more thanks to Richard Robinson and Victoria Sang, who allowed me to make this recording at the campus radio station, WUTM FM 90.3. The Hawk. And finally, thanks to Chris Baxter, another professor of political science at the University of Tennessee at Martin, who arranged this visit and who actually allowed me to teach a session of his administrative law class. I hope I didn't do too much damage, Chris. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howe of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Historic Home Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.